Good morning, afternoon, or evening, wherever or whenever you are. This is the Lightning Podcast, where we discuss and explore the weekly meditations without necessarily reaching any conclusions. Welcome. I'm your host, Cyrus Polizman. I'm joined today by Nico Sarian and Zohar Atkins, but also a new guest, Harry Jacobs. How are you, my friend? Care to introduce yourself?
I'm doing well. I appreciate the invitation. I am Harry Jacobs. I am a voice actor, among other things. I am someone that has read a number of lightning meditations, so those that are listening may recognize my voice. You and I do the majority of them, Cyrus, so they'll either know yours or know mine in general. So
I don't think they'll forget yours. Yeah.
They probably won't forget it. I would be the guy. Go ahead.
Yeah, why don't you read us the quote?
So let's do that. Today's quote is, "The value of a commodity or the quantity of any other commodity for which it will exchange depends on the relative quantity of labor which is necessary for its production and not on the greater or less compensation which is paid for that labor." David Ricardo on the Principles of Political Economy and Taxation. Probably should have read that two or three times before I read it for the podcast, but this is what happens. I read it and then I stumble on my words and then I get to go back and say, Cyrus, would you edit this?
I always give Harry the editorial notes and I'm a bit of a freaking sucker for the details, but okay. We got Zohar here now. We got Zohar to explain it for us. Zohar, what the heck does that mean?
Ricardo is an underappreciated guest and thinker. We all know Adam Smith, who we discussed last time. We know Karl Marx as well. Ricardo doesn't get as much play, but he was a British economist from the same time as John Stuart Mill and Malthus and Adam Smith. And one of the questions that the Brits were interested in was what makes something valuable? And labor was, everybody agreed that labor is part of the ingredient in making something valuable, but there were different opinions about how fundamental labor is. And Ricardo's point, just to simplify it, is perhaps intuitive to many of us, but wasn't at the time that he was writing, which is that the value of the labor isn't dependent upon what it produces, but how easy or hard it is to come by that labor. For example, it's irrelevant whether being an Uber driver is highly skilled. It's not essentially relevant whether it requires a lot of skill to drive an Uber or not. What matters is how many Uber drivers are available at the time that you need the Uber. And I mention Uber specifically because Uber does surge pricing. So if you're somewhere random at 3 a.m, they can charge you triple. And is the value of that ride more than the value of the same ride from the same place at a different time of day? Technically, not really, because the physical skill is needed to drive that car at 3 a.m. versus at noon. But the number of drivers are fewer at 3 a.m. So that's what makes it valuable. And you can extrapolate this principle to many things in life. It's said about career advice, do what you love. But if everybody loves that same thing, you're going to have a very hard time being successful, even if you're really good at it. And I think it's notable that Ricardo used the word commodity. So what is a commodity? In modern investing, a commodity is that which has no differentiation, that which is substitutable. For example, sugar is a commodity. How many of you, when you put a pack of sugar in your tea or coffee, think about the brand of the sugar company that made it? Are you like, oh yeah, I want to have, I don't know, equal sugar? Or you're just like, get me some sugar, right? And so sugar is a great example of something that's a commodity, where you don't actually care who made the sugar. Was it sugar made in Ghana or Brazil? Doesn't matter to you, just want the sugar. But for many other things, what you want is the specific labor. You want the specific brand. You want a Coca-Cola, not just a cola or a pop or soda. And Ricardo is scratching the surface and giving us this idea in its inception, which is some labor is commoditized labor. It doesn't matter who's doing it. Other labor is not commoditized, and only some people can do it. And what you're paying for is the specificity of the person doing it. All of that is a long backstory to explain why it is that when you open up Gregory Mankiw's Introduction to Macroeconomics textbook, which is the one that I learned in high school and college, and he was an advisor in the Bush administration, it begins with the following anecdote or following question. Why should Tiger Woods not mow his own lawn?
I would like to interject, and I realize that I'm new to the party. And I am, just so the audience that's watching or listening understands this, I'm a guy that grew up in Worcester, Massachusetts, and graduated from Doherty Memorial High School on a plea deal with the district attorney. So I may not be the guy that fits in with a discussion about philosophy, but I would like to at this time quote the great philosopher Saul Goodman, attorney at large, who said, "You guys don't want to mess with that. I got a guy who's got a guy, and that guy has a guy that will take care of this for you." And to me, that, as silly as that all is, it means something. Why would Walter White and Jesse spend time doing X task when there's a guy that can do it less? Why would Tiger Woods mow his lawn if there's a guy that will do that for $100 or $200 or whatever the number is? So he doesn't have to waste his time.
And Tiger Woods could be better. This is, I think, the Ricardo point. Tiger Woods could be better than the guy who knows the guy who knows the guy. But how much better could he be than that guy? Okay, the difference between a lawn that's mowed to absolute perfection and one that's good enough, what's the magnitude difference between those two lawns versus between the number one golfer in the world and the number 10 golfer in the world? Now, don't tell that to the maestro of lawn mowing. Maybe they'll be like, "I've got a craft here. You don't realize I'm 100x better than the next guy." But it doesn't really matter whether he thinks that. What matters is, does the market price that in? Or does the market just say, okay, lawn mowing, there's excellent lawn mowing, good lawn mowing, and fair lawn mowing, and those are the categories. But in golf, we have so many categories of excellence that the difference between, who's the number two golfer in the world? Does anyone here know?
I don't know. It's been a while.
I don't follow golf, but that's the point. Everybody knows the number one, and then nobody knows the number two.
Yeah, but Tiger is not number one anymore.
Right. He's not number one, but he's still the
Tiger is Tiger. That's the.
You know what Tiger has done? Tiger has done something in advertising or branding, or if you look at your quote from like the capitalist perspective for a second, think about this. Think about what people do when they build companies and they build brands. They want to build something that's synonymous with whatever it is. I don't know what the number one brand of sugar is, but I can tell you that Band-Aid is a brand. But when people cut their finger, what do they say? They say, "I need a Band-Aid." Yeah. That's it's technically a bandage, but people say Band-Aid. So when you say Tiger Woods, there's no one that's not going to say golf. He has created what they call in advertising, in a way, unaided recall. When you think of golf, who's it? It's everyone's going to say Tiger.
And I think Ricardo is the one who sets this up, meaning he teaches us that you want to be in an industry where you have the opportunity to be the Kleenex of that industry, the Heinz ketchup of that industry. But there are some industries where it might not be possible, where the labor is not seen as fundamental to the value.
So is this why he specifies commodity? This is what he's saying?
I think so. So Ricardo coined a bunch of concepts. One of them was this idea of comparative advantage. It's been popularized today. If you read a lot of career books, they'll say, what's your edge? What's your secret sauce? That's all coming from Ricardo. Ricardo basically took this question of why should Tiger Woods not mow his own lawn, and he applied it to nations. He said that every nation has one thing that makes it really good, and it should focus on that thing rather than trying to do everything. So you have to ask yourself, okay, if you're America, what is the thing that makes you Tiger Woods? If you're China, what's the thing that makes you Tiger Woods? But don't try to copy somebody else and compete with them, because then what you end up doing is you get into a kind of bidding war, and then the price falls to zero.
So basically, we have him to thank for like globalization of the interconnectivity of nations. Each fills a certain role in the production chain of essential products.
And also that he was a proponent of free trade. So yes, But the thing that is unappreciated is this paradox of how does free trade relate to monopoly? My grandfather was an antitrust lawyer. He was a trust buster. And so one of the things that he would do is try to find companies that conspire with one another to keep the prices artificially high. That's what an oligopoly is. A monopoly is even better than an oligopoly because it doesn't have to conspire with anyone. It can just set its own prices and there's nothing you can do about it. So monopoly, and we all play the board game growing up, monopoly is a problem if you're into free markets because they set the prices above what they should be, and thus they create market inefficiency. Okay, so that's one view on monopoly, which is monopoly is it's a dirty word. It's a bad word. I know we play the game Monopoly and you're trying to be a monopolist, but like ultimately the government goes after you if you're a monopoly. But if you read Peter Thiel, 0 to 1, he basically says that what you want is to be a monopoly. And that the beauty of the free market is that it enables you to become a monopoly. Now, he's not talking about a monopoly that is self-dealing and corrupt, but rather this idea that if you have something that nobody else has, then you can charge the world for it if they value it, and there's nothing anyone can do about it. And the other point that Thiel makes, which is a fascinating point, is that if you're a monopoly, you want to pretend that you're not. And if you're not a monopoly, then you want to pretend that you are. Google has a monopoly in search, but if it admits this, then the government will bust it. So it's like, what do you mean? We don't do search. We do 1,000 things. We're Alphabet. We also do self-driving cars and this and that, but fundamentally their money is in search. And then restaurants, which are hyper-competitive with one another, like most restaurants go out of business. And they're like, no, our restaurant is different because we do Chinese food that's also vegan, paleo, and we support these causes, and 10% of your spend at our restaurant goes to the war in Ukraine. We're different. We're a completely other category. No, you're just a restaurant. And there's 10 other ones on the same street that if I'm not in the mood for you, I'll go to them. So all of this, just to bring it back to Ricardo, is to say that Ricardo wants us to find the thing in which we are monopolistic, I believe. The thing like Thiel in which we can charge the world because nobody else can do it. And the way to do this is you have to do two things, okay? You have to do something that nobody else can do or wants to do. That's on the supply side. But at the same time, you have to do something that lots of people want, need, and are willing to pay for. So you have to be, and I think I just tweeted this, you have to be an obscurantist and a populist. If you're just a populist, so obscurantist means you do something obscure enough that nobody's going to try to copy you, but populist enough that everybody's going to want it. It's almost like a 2x2. You could do something that lots of people also want to do, but then you're going to be competitive with them and it's going to be hard for you to be good as a business. You could also do something that nobody else wants to do. Nobody else to beanbag throwing competitions in Antarctica and be the best at that in the world, but there's also probably not a large audience for that, so it doesn't really matter. But if you could find out how to do something that nobody else is thinking to do and that everybody wants, then you've got something special. And that's where the labor theory of value would come into place, is that the value of the labor it's not determined by what you produce. It's determined by how many other people are also able to produce it.
I want to say one thing or two things, and I'm treading very carefully here because I still feel a little bit of insecurity being the new guy.
Not at all, Harry. You're in the same boat as me, bro. Don't worry about it. These guys are geniuses.
There are a couple of things that are important in what you just said that I'm taking. And one of them, you were talking about monopoly a moment ago. And Google. And when you speak to the least sophisticated consumer, right? The person that knows the least about the business world, I'll use my 80-year-old mother as an example, who when she doesn't know something, she'll say, I will Google it. I will get a Band-Aid for my, right? She has no idea about Google Meet or Google Calendar or Google Docs or any of that. But Google has, in a sense, created a monopoly on search, because that's the unaided recall I was talking about with Band-Aid. So they are, in a sense, they have that monopoly without, what's that?
Yeah. Do we know if the government like uses unaided recall, that term, to like in its cases for monopoly?
I learned that term from a guy that I worked for in radio 35 years ago, who said, what you want to do with our radio station or our brand or whatever is create unaided recall, so that when people think about, and this is a crazy example compared to what we're talking about, when people think about Led Zeppelin, they think about our radio stations, unaided recall. It's a dream for a radio station that doesn't exist, like it does in corporate America, where you go, this is reality, right? For Google to start this and go, we want to be the brand that is exclusively associated with search. So when someone needs to figure something out, they go, I'm going to Google it. And that's, as a guy who's in business, I wish I could create a brand that people would say, I'm going to Google that. And I think that's important, whatever side of the fence you sit on, whether you're a capitalist or a socialist or what, this is what's happened with Google.
Yeah. No one says, I'm going to go surf the web.
Can you read the quote one more time?
Yes, absolutely. And I'll do it without a mistake. This time. The value of a commodity or the quantity of any other commodity for which it will exchange depends on the relative quantity of labor which is necessary for its production, and not on the greater or less compensation which is paid for that labor. David Ricardo, on the principles of political economy and taxation.
So I think he makes an argument that it depends on X, but he also makes another argument, which is, and it doesn't depend on Y. So another way into this quote would be to think about, what is he refuting or what is he arguing against? He's arguing against the view that the value of something is determined by what you pay the laborer. If I pay somebody to mow my garden $20 an hour, they take 3 hours to do it, then is the value of what they have accomplished $60? Have they produced $60 of value? You could say in that moment, perhaps they have, because I was willing to pay $60 for it, so I valued it at $60. But I think what he's saying is, why am I willing to pay $20 an hour? So the answer to the question of why you pay the labor, what you pay the labor, is not answered in the other definition. So you have to go a layer deeper. In other words, to account for the value that's being produced, you have to go to the question of how much do people want to do this task? And if everybody's raising their hand and saying, I'll do it, then maybe you can pay someone $10 to do it. Versus if nobody's raising their hand, maybe you have to pay them $100 to do it. And people could raise their hands or not raise their hands for all kinds of different reasons. And his theory is neutral. His is just saying the value is the consequence of how many people are raising their hands to do the job. I think is an interesting understanding of value. And I think we should probably dig deeper into why some people raise their hands for certain kinds of jobs and not for others, and what that actually then ends up doing economically to our sense of what's valuable. Yeah, Cyrus.
So I'm looking at the quote, and he says, it depends on the relative quantity of labor which is necessary for its production, not, and maybe it's just the use of language was different at the time, but he says necessary for its production. He doesn't say available for its production. So I'm wondering if maybe we're focusing too much on, because it sounds like we're looking at what's available, the availability of labor versus like the necessity of labor. So if we interpret it that way, then we're saying something totally different.
Okay, so what are we saying then in your interpretation? Oh, go.
Nico, sorry, what?
Yeah, one thing that should be understood is that, I'm going to go off a tangent for a second to come back, that actually the origins of economics, or like one of the big questions that started the whole discipline, is how do you determine value? Can you atomize value, economic value? So when you look at David Ricardo, Adam Smith, the early 18th century French economist, the whole point is, how can we reach a unit of value, no? That is not relative. And one of the things that Karl Marx took from Ricardo, and this quote points to that, is that there is exchange value and use value are two different things. So you cannot determine the value of something by looking at its price. And this is why labor pops up in Ricardo as a more essential form, if you will, of the index of value, no? Because again, like if you look at the stock market, it's a great example. So the price of a given stock, let's say, I don't know, Something has an insane P like Nvidia or like any, Nvidia is perhaps a complicated one, but I can brag about that. But let's say something has an insane P ratio, like that does not determine the value of the stock. It's just the value of the exchange, no? What the market says it's worth. It's not representative of any of the financials, no? Any of, let's say, of the, what you would call it, say, actually, Wall Street versus...
We don't actually know what the intrinsic value is of a company at any given point. The market is basically people like going to war with one another over what they think its value is based upon all kinds of assumptions of where it's going. And so that point applies here, which is to say that there's an intrinsic value to something as well as a perceived value, and the perceived value versus the intrinsic value are not always the same. So now how do you apply? So intrinsic value.
It's that easy. And this is what I was going to say about Ricardo, because this is just a quote, but I mean, when I studied Ricardo, whatever, back in college, the problem was the following is that, okay, fine. Labor is there. No? And he says, as you said, Cyrus, why does he say relative quantity of labor, which is necessary? No, it's like there seems to be, it seems that Ricardo is hedging on the fact that there is some sort of minimum necessary to produce X. No, and the problem is, okay, fine, that's the minimum, let's say, intrinsic value of a commodity. No, not the price. Not the problem is that, okay, so how do you value? How do you measure that? No, how do you measure that, let's say, relative minimum, let's say minimum as a necessary relative quantity of labor? And the problem, that's the problem with Ricardo, is that the only way you can measure that is through other commodities, for instance. And this is where the idea of a basic income, or a basic income in the sense that you need not the money, but in order for the person to produce, let's say, Band-Aids, which is what Harry was talking about. Let's say if a person has to produce 10 Band-Aids in a day, no? What is the minimum necessary to make that person, let's say, get out of the bed and be able to get to work to do it?
So are you searching for the term minimum wage? Is that the term you're...
But yeah, it's connected to that as well. It's this form of policy that in order for you to achieve like the minimum required, there should be something that is, let's say, set as an axiom for the economy. So a person must make this minimum amount of money. The problem is that, okay, how do you establish that? How do you establish what is the minimum? And what Ricardo says, or if you look at the principles of political economy and taxation, the problem is that, okay, I need to, let's say, get 10 Band-Aids. So what does that equal in terms of, let's say, caloric expenditure? I don't know. 4 eggs, a loaf of bread, and a beer, or something like this. and the problem. And that's the...
Ricardo didn't consider unions either, right? There were no unions at that point, right? The union, right?
No, but what I'm trying to go to with this whole thing is that the idea of having an intrinsic form of value is not as easy as saying, okay, there's something that is intrinsic and then there's exchange value, which is a qua commodity. Because again, like how do you achieve the status of a commodity? Like people didn't, like, I don't know, back in, sugar was an import brought from the colonies in the, let's say, 17th, 18th, 16th, no? It was a luxury. People didn't consume sugar before. So there is much more of a, call it cultural / social mimetic component to what do we value and how do we value it, than, let's say, just a purely intrinsic utilitarian idea of what value is, no? Of like, you need X, let's say, you need three eggs and a loaf of bread to get up and go to work type of thing.
Whenever you listen, whenever you read a philosopher, you should be asking yourself at least two questions. One is, what are they saying about the world that's true? The other is, what are they saying to me that's useful? We can debate whether Ricardo has a correct view of how economics works. He's one of the first economists, first modern economists, trying to understand complex international trade. There's also an aspect, and this is the one that I was trying to emphasize because I think of our endeavor as a self-help one, not that I'm opposed to understanding the truth, but which is, what does Ricardo mean for me? Which is, okay, given that the default is that labor is viewed as a commodity, given that products are viewed as just the expressions of lots of labor coming together to produce it, how can I find something in my life that I can make that is valuable and that is not easily commoditized? And what are the things that prevent it from becoming commoditized? In the world of investing, you ask about companies. What's that company's moat? What makes it defensible? How do I know that it's going to exist in 20 years rather than being put out of business by some young upstart? And if you can answer that question, in a way, Ricardo is a challenge to you. He's a productive challenge, which is, he's telling you that the value of something is simply the ability to produce it. So the harder it is to produce the thing, the combined with how desired it is, those two things go hand in hand, the more valuable it would be. So you have to find something that's difficult to produce and that's desired. If you find something that's easy to produce and desired, you have no advantage. If you find something that's hard to produce but not desired, that seems particularly, that's like writing avant-garde poetry. So that's, I think, a question. And he coined the phrase comparative advantage as like a challenge to us. What is your comparative advantage? Now, I think it's instructive to think about all the things that would make us not get out of bed. That's how I would go about answering this question. What would make me not get out of bed in the morning to go and do something? So one would be if the job is dangerous. So, right. So we put a premium on something which is dangerous. There's a meme going on right now on TikTok. I'm not on TikTok, but I heard about this. You guys will find this funny. Of young teenagers or maybe college grads who call up their parents, and it's all on video because it's like the narcissistic generation. And they're like, "Hey, mom, I got a job working at Exxon." And "Oh, that's great, honey. What's the job?" And "I'm in the underwater oil rig." And then the parents are like, "What?" And then, "Yeah, it's really cool." And just deadpanning their parents, the parents like realize, and like, the pay is amazing, right? And that's the point is, yeah, because how many people want to work on an underwater oil rig?
Goes back to our conversation of many managed to sell what they could never give away.
Yeah, exactly. I think another one, like danger is probably an extreme one, right? Risking your life. Exactly this quote from Stendhal, many managed to sell what they could never give away. So doing anything that others would perceive as, oh, I would never do that. And so what are those things that are of low status? Nobody wants to be thought of as a fool. That's a great opportunity for finding an advantage. Because if you're willing to look like a fool, then maybe you can do something and charge a premium for it.
The pay scale for the narcissist on TikTok appears to be quite high for people that have even less education than I do, are making money that I never dreamed of making with a phone and a couple of silly ideas, right?
I think that the top 10 creators are making a killing such that now, if you poll the youth and say, what's your most desired profession? They'll say influencer. But then the next 10 are not making very much. Hollywood as well.
I don't know if this was our conversation on Stendhal, but remember we were talking about labor and acting, Cyrus, remember that? I wonder if like a kid today says, oh, mommy, I want to be an influencer. If it's like telling a parent, I'm thinking boomers here, but there's no boomers there. It's, oh, mommy, I want to be a musician or like a rock star or an actor, no? If it's on that scale, no?
I think it probably is. I think are kids you would talk to of a certain age that would say, I want to be an influencer. You see it on Instagram. I follow the Lightning Podcast on Instagram, but I also follow others. And sometimes I'll look at a bio. I don't see on Cyrus's bio that he's an influencer, but in a way he is, but he's also not an 18-year-old kid. But these kids that are creating these ridiculous videos, their dream is not to act in a movie like Cyrus would act, but their goal is to be on a TikTok that would influence 50 or 100,000 of their young friends.
Right.
Right. There's.
I would like to see the maturity of that career, though, the longevity of being an influencer. We don't know that yet.
Yeah.
How long can you stay relevant?
I would look at the Kardashians no further than the Kardashians.
You can't really compare Kim because that's right.
First they started out on Kardashians invented this category of the influencer. So I think that as much as a person might want to like chuckle at them, the ridiculousness of the product, I think it's in a way it's a distraction from the ingenuity that they created a whole new industry. They created a whole new vertical, which was the attention economy as the self-referentially powerful thing, the being famous for being famous effect. If you are the first to invent this, in some sense, you deserve credit for it. I read a book called Self-Made, which argues that this the Kardashian effect is just using the power of technology to do something that already in the early modern period, artists were beginning to do, turning themselves into the subject of the artwork and creating celebrity around them.
Here's a term that you won't read in philosophy. Maybe you will, or we will, 100 years or 200 years down the road. But what the Kardashians and Paris Hilton and all that group, that clique, they're professional opportunists in a way. Are they not?
That is something that is, let's say, prescient of philosophy, I would say. And I can give you an example. Zohar, I think that Kim Kardashian is the confirmation of everything that Walter Benjamin talked about. Kim famous. Because she's famous. That's it. That's the groundswell that she like that's generated. It's like the only reason why people follow Kim is because people follow Kim. That's it. There is no, let's say, underlying. Perhaps you can trace it back to the sex tape with Reggie Jackson
or Reggie Bush.
That was the inciting incident.
Reggie Bush. But it wasn't. She wasn't that popular after. Anyway, it's something that just got generated. Of it's like the Mona Lisa. The reason why the Mona Lisa is whatever is the most famous painting in our history or in the world or whatever is because it was the first image that was mechanically reproduced in a newspaper, and a lot of people saw it. Not because Da Vinci, blah, 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 and all of this stuff.
The interesting thing, if I may, I was going to bring up the sex tape, and I didn't want to get my hand slapped. But that tape, it was the origin of it. But I heard something from a friend of mine whom I trust very dearly, and I had heard it previously, just a few weeks ago, that the mother was involved in that, in the production and distribution of that. And as silly as it's that we're laughing at it, if my daughter were involved in that, if my wife was involved in putting that out, what does that say about the mom? Yeah. But either from a business perspective, had the foresight to say, by the way, if you look at the timeline, it was Paris Hilton's tape, and then they were upset. The Kardashians were upset. And so the next one that came out was Kim's. And again, the mother involved. To me, it's mind-boggling that a mother would do that to her child, but she's created this unbelievable empire.
I want to take it in two different directions, a little bit away from the family drama. So one is the question of outliers, why it is that the person who's number one in the field could be 100 times or 1,000 times more famous or more successful than the number two. And a related question to this is, why do we have so many outliers today? It seems like we have more outliers than ever. I'll get into this topic. And then the second, though, just to tie into the mother, is Michael Jordan. If you ever see the movie Air, which is about the invention of the Air Jordans, there's an amazing scene where Matt Damon goes to Michael Jordan's mother and says, "You and I are the only two people in the world who know something that the world has yet to know, and that's how spectacular Michael Jordan is." And he understood that if you want to get to Michael Jordan, you have to go through the mother. And that there is that almost like prophetic knowledge of somebody becoming great before it happens. So I thought that was interesting. So I'm not trying to draw too hard of a connection to Kim's mom. Maybe she knew. The outlier point, though, I personally don't think that it's sufficient to explain Kardashian's fame in terms of her fame. So I personally reject that. I think that we should rather take a more generational view and just appreciate why, how come it is that in every field we have people breaking records like never before. Like even Taylor Swift has won more awards and is more wealthy and more famous and all this than Michael Jackson. And it's what? We all thought Michael Jackson was generational. And then you think of Elon Musk, and he's created multiple incredible companies, not just one. He's got Tesla and SpaceX and Neuralink. And it's like an outlier amongst outliers, is my point. And then you look at basketball, and I don't even follow basketball that much, but you have people in a game, like multiple people scoring 60, 70 points. It's what? I remember growing up where you thought it was pretty amazing if somebody scored 30 or 40 points in a game. So what is going on with our world such that we are getting these outliers? And I don't really have an answer for it, but almost a spiritual question, which is like, why has God set up the world? Just because I'm a theologian. So I'm now.
But maybe you have a lot of outliers. There's much more outliers, but there's also much more stupid people or uninteresting people at the same time. It's just getting bigger.
What's interesting too about what you're talking about, you brought up Taylor Swift. I would not know a Taylor Swift song if it hit me in the forehead. But I, as a guy who watches football every Sunday, I look at the purists that I watch football with, and they're all angry about Taylor Swift and what she's done for football. I think what she's done for football is magnificent, because if I were Roger Goodell, I'd be making arrangements to have her. I would have made arrangements to have her at the Super Bowl. To me, she's brought millions and millions of new people into football. There's I don't know if that's a good connection to this, but to me, I look at some of this and I go, there's incredible value there to them.
That's my point. It's wow.
Yeah.
There's a conspiracy theory of sorts, and I don't even think it's that conspiratorial, that Taylor Swift has the power to decide the election.
I don't disagree with that.
And it's like listen to Taylor Swift? Not really. Do I think Taylor Swift is talented? I would say that's even an irrelevant question. We're explaining Taylor Swift in light of Ricardo. Okay, so the point is, Ricardo predicts.
That's the lighting podcast.
You don't want to be commoditized, you have to become Taylor Swift. There's no middle ground, really. Taylor Swift and Elon Musk and all these, I don't know, who's that guy in the NBA now, 7 feet plus tall and is from another country?
Yeah, the guy that scored 60 points. No, I think he's Serbian or something, no?
Yeah. So it's like these kind of people are rejoinders to the challenge, which is the value of your labor depends upon the quantity of that labor being necessary. And so I guess in the case of Taylor Swift, only Taylor Swift can do what she does. You have to find something that's got a je ne sais quoi about it where nobody else could do it or even try to do it. And it's difficult to explain these things in advance, but in retrospect, we just nod our heads as if it's normal. Next week, we'll be discussing a Steve Jobs quote that people don't know what they want. You have to show it to them. But I think that pairs really beautifully with this idea that nobody expects a Taylor Swift to become as big as she's become at the beginning. But then once she does, you look back at every other pop star and they seem not in terms of musical talent, but in terms of just the economic value capture that she's managed to achieve.
I want to circle back to it's connected to everything you said when you were talking about monopolies and as market inefficiency initially with Peter Thiel and 0-1. My question is the following. I'm going off a little bit of the tangent, but I want to come back to what you were saying is who says that the monopoly is a market inefficiency?
Is a market inefficiency?
Yeah, because monopolies create markets. Initially, they do, at least. It's Band-Aid, perhaps a bad example because people get injured. And this will connect to next week's quote. But the idea being that there is something that is new, it's a monopoly because it's new. No, it's it's disrupted, like
the answer hinges on the phrase barriers to entry. Now, I don't know who coined this word.
Right.
I have to go Google it after this. Go Google it. There are some barriers to entry which we consider to be kosher and noble. And if you can achieve those barriers to entry, then we give you a round of applause. But there are other barriers to entry where we say that's shenanigans, that's corruption, that's not allowed, right? And sometimes it's a gray area. But for example, if you have the intellectual property to something and you've discovered something and you've gotten it patented, we give you a round of applause and we say that is you've created a legitimate barrier to entry and you should be compensated for it. But if every time somebody tries to challenge you, you use your influence to crush them in ways that are not legal, so that would be a problem, right? And then there's probably ways you could crush them where you have the legal ability and therefore you should do it from a game theory perspective. But we still think maybe it's unfair because now this incumbent is using the force of their legacy to defend themselves instead of letting their product stand on its own.
Taylor Swift.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, like, we're not trying. We're not trying. The person who's doing a business or like creating a product or like establishing a monopoly naturally, they're not trying to save the world. They're trying to make money. At least there's a reason why they're exchanging something. Otherwise, I made this amazing invention. I'm not going to sell it. I'm just going to give it out and people can order it. That's the market thing. That's the market problem, is that exchange. What is the role of exchange there? If we're bringing morals into the question of what a person is doing is subject to the law or not.
I bring in morality only because if you stop your opponent through shenanigans, you are, that's a very precise economic term.
Shenanigans.
If you use shenanigans to stop your competition, just think of sports. If you're a runner and you take a club to your competition, we just see that as that's a violation of sports.
If you pull a Tanya Harding.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and then there's probably what we allow, a certain amount of shit talking. Like if you're like, you try to intimidate your opponent, we're like, yeah, that's okay, because that's part of the game. But there's probably some areas between that where you'd be like, okay, you go to the person's house the night before and try to intimidate them. Okay, that's taking it a little too far.
But that's not the problem. But the problem is that
it's a violation of the game. Competition is good. Competition makes it better.
What you don't want is
to just be complacent and rest in the fact that now that they're number one, they can coast. You want them to feel that the number two is coming for them and that they still need to practice and to be driven or they're going to lose their seat. The paradox is just the tension between, on the one hand, competition being good because it forces everybody to stay, what's the word, excellent and stay striving. But then at the same time, you don't want to be in a position where you're always competing. Because if you're always neck and neck, then you don't really have a lasting advantage. So you want to be in your own lane, singing to your own song. So that's why Peter Thiel says don't compete, and why his own personal story confirms his teaching, because he started off as a lawyer in a fancy law firm and walked out after, I believe, a year. And everybody looked at him like, what? You can do that? And the point being that if you're a lawyer at a fancy law firm, you put in your 10, 20, 30 years, and you try to work your way up to partner and senior partner and whatever. And the game is prescribed and it's largely a tournament, but what you're doing is commoditized. It's this Ricardo paradigm. And there's a time and a place for that. Many people do choose to compete in the tournament, but if you don't want to be commoditized, then you have to find something that not 100 other people are trying to do.
But I understand, this is my reading of Thiel in 0-1, is that the type of competition that he's thinking about, and I'm saying this from the consumer side, not the supplier side, is not, let's say, neck to neck, as you say. It's more, there is a product, no? And then, again, like, there's more uninteresting and dumb people than outliers. So what's going to happen is that most people that are going to enter that market are just going to repeat the product in a very uninteresting way. And what you're going to get at the end of the day is you walk into a supermarket and you get 20 varieties of mayo and they all taste the same. you know? And I see that as a market inefficiency. Let's say, this is my reading, you know? That you're not getting quality and, let's say, a division of not only of labor, which is, I guess, I'm like prophesizing Smith here, but a variety, let's say, more varieties within the market, more goods. What you're getting is a monopoly, not a monopoly, but just like the same product repeated infinitely. And they call it different. Yeah.
Stagnation.
You can get growth from that, but you're not like, there is nothing new. It's just a different like flavor of the mayo. Like, it's a, I mean, this is why Thiel says that there hasn't been really any real technological development since the Concorde. Yeah, you had the iPhone, but look at the subways. It's like
it's difficult. It's difficult to know in advance whether what you're doing is just more of the same or whether it's an innovation. And this is where you have the Steve Jobs quote is helpful, that people want to be, you have to show people what they want, not give them what they want. If I told you that I had a new flavor of ice cream, it's the lightning flavor. Hopes and dreams with a twist of fudge.
I would eat ice cream every day if I could, by the way, for the record. So you had my attention immediately as soon as you said, I have a new flavor of ice cream. Here we go. This is what I was looking to gain from this podcast.
But is that flavor so, like categorically new such that you can say, okay, now he's done an innovation. He's gone from zero to one. Or it's okay, yeah, because the world really needs another flavor of ice cream. And it's, I think my default assumption is, okay, the world doesn't really need another flavor of ice cream. Come on, like you and everybody else has a new flavor of ice cream, a new ice cream brand, blah, 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 blah. Like that's the epitome of commodity. So we already know all the players. On the other hand, who's to say I don't have a mind-blowing new ice, like a new flavor? What if in 100 years, like there's chocolate, vanilla, and lightning? Right, so we don't know actually. And give me that light.
Keep talking. I don't care what Nico says or what Cyrus, those skinny bastards, say. I am inside of me is a fat guy that would eat ice cream every day.
Where do you go, Harry? That's what I want.
Yeah, what's your go-to ice cream place?
I've actually gone to keto ice cream because regular ice cream is not good for me. So,
keto ice cream.
I want to just try to read something. So let me pull up this quote from Ricardo. I just have an idea.
Three eggs and a loaf of bread.
Yeah.
The value of a scoop of ice cream, the quantity of any other scoop of ice cream for which it will exchange depends on the relative quantity of labor which is necessary for its production, and not on the greater or less compensation which is paid for that labor.
You know what? I want to go back to the ice cream for a minute and say something serious. As a guy who lost 100 pounds in 2018, so between 2018 and now I'm down 100 pounds. Damn. One of the things I did was I did keto for my diet. But when I found Rebel Creamery made keto ice cream and Robert Irwin made these bars that had 5 grams of sugar, the value of that to me, to be able to have something sweet and not think I'm just going to live on bacon and sausage and eggs and cheese, is tremendous. So it's in the eye of the beholder. There's an expression in the car business, right? There's an ass for every seat. There is someone that will find value. As a guy who's got an inner fat kid living in him, to have the option to eat one of 10 flavors of ice cream that doesn't really have any sugar in it, or have a protein bar that tastes like a candy bar, that value is tremendous. It's almost invaluable. Beautiful. Right? I'll pay whatever.
That's a fantastic example, because I think in the example of the keto ice cream, there's a typical need that is implicit in the purchase of ice cream. And then you introduce this other need, which is the need not to get fat from eating it. So it's like, how do you address both of those needs at the same time? The need to indulge your desire for sweets and at the same time not suffer the consequences of this. So that's a genuine innovation. I think it points to, it's a good critique on my, we have a new lightning flavor ice cream, which is okay, but what need does that new flavor solve? So I think that is actually a fantastic point, is that a lot of people focus on the features of their new product. Like, look, it does this and this. But the only way to really know if it's a new thing is if it solves a new need or solves an old need in a way that nobody else is solving. Is there really a need for this new flavor? Probably not. But would there be a need for a flavor that also can give you heartburn? Yeah.
Or if it creates a new need.
Yeah.
No?
Yeah.
I'm going to sell you on what you don't have.
Yeah.
This ice cream will inspire you. You'll be able to write an essay in 5 minutes if you eat a scoop of this ice cream.
I think the need that Taylor Swift serves, by the way, if I had to hypothesize, is the need for it's the need for celebrity and the need for relatability. And most celebrities, by definition, are unrelatable. In fact, part of why you adore them is because you're like, wow, they're living such a spectacular life and I'm still stuck in my ordinary life. But Taylor Swift often sings about and talks about how she's like a victim and she suffers with this and that. And I think that people listen to that and they're like, yeah, she's famous, but she's also like me.
It's funny because I pay attention to what I'm seeing when I see her. And the football guys will say, they've shown her 8 times. Why are they doing that? Look at the way she pays attention to that game. Look at the way she looks at him. Look at how invested she is. You know what I mean? And she's brought all these celebrities to the kind of the field with her and has created a new thing for the NFL. I think she's the greatest gift the NFL has had in years. My opinion, she's a gift to Roger Goodell and every one of those owners.
Yeah,
my perspective. Well,
I still don't know her music. To the owners, yeah, she definitely will bring in the money and the celebrities will bring in the money. But I guess what your friends might be upset about is that, like, to them, they were always going to watch, right? They were always going to watch football no matter what. They were there in the beginning and they came to watch football. They weren't there to see cameos of celebrities. So I can see where they're getting at. But what you could spin to them, and I'm sure you did, is that by them panning to the celebrities and they are getting the attention of other people who weren't interested in football, come to watch football, and those people coming to watch football gives more money to the NFL to then make football more accessible to you.
What difference does it make whether they're cutting away to Taylor Swift or some huge overweight ice cream eater that's got his body painted in 3 different colors and a mask and some Bob the Fireman at the New York Jets game?
Or see one of the coaches like talking like this.
I'll tell you what. This is, at first I thought, where are we going with this? But now I understand. It's all about recognition. So essentially, when people watch and they want to see themselves represented. And I think that this comes down to this zero-sum culture we have, where if one group is represented, it means I'm not represented. If Taylor Swift is being spotlighted, that means that we're trying to rebrand the NFL as, oh, also maybe like young teenage girls could be interested in this. And you're like an older gentleman and you're watching and you're like, I want to see Bob the Fireman because that's me. So Taylor Swift actually is in some sense, and it's like, why can't the NFL be for everyone? But I understand this idea of, hey, if you're a loyal person, this goes to Cyrus's point, then don't you feel like you should be given priority as a shareholder rather than just trying to be welcoming? And you see this in, by the way, church and synagogue and mosques, where there's often internal politics around, should the cult, and I'm using that word with a asterisk, don't be offended by it. I'm using it in the anthropological sense, not the culty sense. should the cult focus on expanding membership and welcoming the stranger and the person who's just passing through? Or should they focus on serving their base and strengthening the ties that bind of those who have put in their time and are going to pass it on to the next generation? And you could say, why not both? But in reality, it's very hard to create that sense of an in-group and also be open to the stranger. So you create the in-group identity around being welcoming, but then who's actually in the in-group to do that welcoming, if you're just porous? And I think we have this problem in so many ways in modernity, where you have easy come, easy go culture with no deep bonds. And then you have very solid bonds and it's not so easy to come and it's not so easy to go. And so depending on where you are, you either really appreciate those ties that bind, because yes, I have a sense of meaning, I have a sense of belonging, or you're like, shucks, they're so exclusive, I always felt like an outsider because I could never enter the group. Or perhaps I didn't conform to that group's rules or morals or whatever it is, and I wanted to get out, and it was hard to leave, it was hard to change. So you could see why people are attracted to the liberal paradigm, the easy come, easy go paradigm. But I think then on the flip side, we have a lot of nihilism and a lot of people adrift because they don't have any specificity or particularity that holds them down to a particular place or a particular community or particular tradition. So I think in a way the Taylor Swift is a great, and the NFL hardliners is a great case study for like tradition and modernity.
You almost want to, I get into a discussion with one of the guys, you know, at the Super Bowl as we were watching. I, you know, as you say, people adrift, men adrift. I spend a lot of time smoking cigars. I go to a cigar shop. Several of you guys know who owns this shop, but I jokingly refer to it as a home for wayward men, right? Those of us that are may not be married, don't have a lot to do, but we're with like-minded people. And I said to one of the guys who was complaining about Taylor Swift, I said, you know what we should have done is we should have had you take a notepad before the game started and mark off how many times they cut into the crowd to show a fan, and then compare and contrast that to how many times they've shown Taylor Swift. I bet they've shown her 1% of the time. What, there's no skin off of your back, right? No one's losing camera. No one that you don't know is losing camera time. It's Taylor Swift. Let it be. Take a deep breath. Relax. It's okay, bro. She's good for football. She's bringing new people in. That's all. Take it. It's not the end of the Taylor Swift is not the end of our world as big meat eating football watching carnivores. Take a breath.
Now, here's the thing. You have a point, and it probably is 1%, but then it's the perceived. Why is it that they perceive her to be so much more present than she is? Because Harry's right. Like, they don't show her that much.
But because she's not one of us and she's getting attention.
By the way, was it Miley Cyrus or Taylor Swift who was the muse of the neo-Nazi movement?
Oh, no. What happened
it's
now?
You know this.
It's not Taylor Swift, I could say with confidence.
It's not Taylor. It's Miley Cyrus?
I don't know anything about it, but yeah. Taylor I've heard Swift this. Is an yeah. object of scorn on the right.
Okay.
Man, I wish she would get married and change her name.
I wish Kim Kardashian would walk into a chess tournament. That would be amazing.
Maybe they could read some classics and promote it for Lightning. I mean, that's
oh Jesus, that would be. Where
hey, so I just looked down. I made a note in the beginning of this, and I know we're wrapping up, but you talked about Uber and surge pricing. I'm based in Vegas for folks that don't know who I am, which is everybody. Mm-hmm. But we just had the F1 here in November, and it was incredible for Vegas. I'm not a race fan. I don't know anything about that, but and I know how to get around Vegas, but there was worth a value to me in taking an Uber that night to get to the strip, to get to the hotel, to get to the dinner I was going to, and to get back home. But my Uber cost me 2 or 3 times what it normally would, especially leaving the Cosmopolitan, which is where I was watching the race from. But that surge pricing, it was worth spending $100 or $180 in Ubers that night to get to and from and to get everywhere I needed to be.
What's the question?
There was no question. It was just about surge pricing. It was a story, and it was about surge pricing, and it was Zohar had brought up in the beginning about surge pricing, and I made a note, and I'm sorry to bring us all back, but I thought there's something interesting in that with value as we wrap up here and the commodity and what things are worth. It was worth it to me to pay 3 times what I would normally pay that night. To avoid nonsense.
It's funny how they hardwired relative inflation into an app. That's insane.
Yeah, crazy.
I'm familiar with this concept of surge pricing by context, but not always by time. For example, you go to the movie theaters and you pay whatever you pay for a bucket of popcorn and a Coke, and it's and same at the airport, you pay a markup, and we're all used to that and we accept that. But this idea that you would be at a different time and pay a markup, that seems unique to our sort of smartphone era where you can almost bring your place with you. So that's an interesting idea. I think we probably, in terms of habit, are used to changing our expectations based upon whether you're in this physical space versus that physical space, But this idea that there's a seasonality to your day or to your week, and you actually now have to abide by that's interesting. And also that it's determined by like crowd dynamics. Like you now have to consider what is happening in Las Vegas that week in a way that you didn't before.
It's a micro market.
Surge pricing happens every day, right? That surge pricing, if I order Uber Eats, I'm a single guy, I live alone. If I want chicken wings, and if I want them at 5 o'clock at night versus 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock at night, the price of my chicken wings goes up because of Uber Eats.
So I'm going to bring it home with it with an idea from Heidegger that will connect to Ricardo and will connect to surge pricing, which is, so in one of his essays in Poetry, Language, and Thought, Heidegger says that the abolition of all distances does not bring us any closer to being. The ability to get to places quicker, the ability to check your phone, he was writing this in the 50s, and get an email instantaneously, none of that brings us any closer to being. In fact, we're further away than ever, despite the fact that we live in this time of instantaneousness. And if proximity to being cannot be measured by the physical distance between two things, and if it can't be measured by the temporal distance between two things, then what is proximity? That's his question. What is proximity if it isn't determined by your physical meridian or your temporal meridian? And the answer that he gives is that it's determined by your relationship, your attitude to being, which is a function of your attitude to yourself and your own most being, which is a deep mystery. And so you can be in a room, and if you're thinking about someone 3,000 miles away, you're actually not in the room. And if you're sitting outside and it's Friday morning, but you're thinking about what you have to do the next week, you're not sitting outside on Friday morning, you're actually, so to say, sitting in 2 weeks from now. And his Heidegger's critical of modern technology because it almost makes us desensitized to this fact and focuses instead on what's measurable. So you can start to think about time and space in terms of units, and that's bad. It's bad that, maybe it's not bad, but if I can turn on my lamp at 3 a.m., then in a sense, I'm transporting the ability to have day at night, even though in Genesis it says God's created day and night, but now I can have day at night. All of that is massively confusing, but Uber's bringing it back and allowing us to experience Heideggerian time and surge pricing on some level, because the fact that I now experience 5 p.m. is different from 9 p.m., even if the trigger for this difference is an economic cost, it's putting me more in touch with the primal experience of time, which is that an hour is not an hour. Certain moments are more dense than other moments. And with that bringing of your attitude to the hour, to the four, it's actually creating an anti-monotony forcing function, where instead of thinking about your day as 24 hours or your week as 7 days, you now can be thinking about the present moment in terms of where did I come from and where am I going? And that was, in Heidegger's view, the authentic relationship to time. Uber for the win, and Ricardo for the win as well, because Ricardo, similarly, I think, is arguing that we not just take a generic view of what a product is and what makes it valuable. We should look under the hood and think about the things that make it differentiated. And we should, in our own way, try to make things that are differentiated, try to find the thing that makes us like Tiger Woods rather than the thing that makes us like the lawnmower. And don't be the guy who knows a guy who knows a guy knows.
It's all good,
man. Who knows the guy who knows the guy. All right.
That was, yeah, Uber should hire you because that was
we should pitch to Uber. We should.
Anyways, guys, we're out of time, but thank you so much for joining Zohar, Harry, Nico. Great episode. More of a business episode today. If you viewers, listeners enjoyed it, you can continue the discussion in our Chronicles WhatsApp group. And you can also find David Ricardo on Alexandria. And another thing you can find on Alexandria are books. And those books are being narrated by Harry Jacobs here and other voice actors we'll be bringing on. And if you have a question for David Ricardo, I guess you can ask the GPT David Ricardo that Nico set up. So there are options to continue this thread for you beyond just this episode. Thanks for listening. Have a good day.